Hello and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me a bit later today will be Peter Wesley Salmon. I'm coming to you live from the secret auxiliary control booth from which we do end credits these days. As I'm recording this, we have just received the news that we are moving on to stage 3 of the reopening. I do not know if that means CFRU will be reopening as part of stage 3. We will have to wait and find out. In the meantime, it's a bit cooler in the auxiliary studio today as we're recording this week's episode, so that is very much appreciated. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new documentary Mucho Mucho Amor, The Legend of Walter Mercado, which is now streaming on Netflix. For the first half, we're gonna kick off another series, which, you know, preparing for maybe, I don't know, maybe not the best move, considering we might be moving into a posture where we can go back to how we would usually do the show, but maybe that's not the best way to play things. Okay, so this new series, I am going to rank every Spielberg movie from the worst to the best. It's going to be... This week there's 12, next week there will be 11, and then in the final week there will be 10. He has an odd number of films in his repertoire, sadly, so that's how we're going to have to do things. And I just want to preface this from the beginning to say, like, the worst Spielberg film is still probably better than the best film from those, like, the guys who did, like, Date Movie and the latter Scary Movies. You know, these things are on a curve. So, just because I'm gonna say something is the one of the worst Spielberg movies, we'll try not to take that personally. Or at least maybe Mr. Spielberg will not take that personally. Okay. So I'm gonna start with Ready Player One at the number 12 spot for this week's sort of the worst of list. Mark Rylance, who has sort of become a sort of a reliable Spielberg player since Bridge of Spies, horribly miscast as the guy who invents this big, huge virtual world and dies and leaves a bunch of clues, and the person who solves the clues will be able to inherit it. He's completely unbelievable as this tech guru. They should have had Simon Pegg do it. Simon Pegg is also in the movie, but he plays the Mark Rylance's co-creator of the virtual world Oasis. But it just, sorry, I could not buy Mark Rylance in this role as sort of the uber geek VR creator of this expansive world. Having said that, Steven Spielberg was still the entirely wrong director for this film, since so much of Ready Player One is about sort of deconstructing. Actually, I wouldn't even call it deconstruction, but it's about so much homage to Steven Spielberg's work, especially, you know, circa 1975 to about 93 when he made Jurassic Park. Spielberg is too ingrained in the popular culture that this movie traffics in to really be able to sort of separate himself from it and do something that was really terribly interesting or had an appropriate commentary on the book and on popular culture. But I'll just leave it at that. One thing about Ready Player One, it supplants 1941 as the worst Spielberg movie. 1941 comes on the heels of Jaws and Close Encounters, but it is completely unfocused. It is completely all over the place. It's got such great comedic talent like Tim Matheson, John Belushi, John Candy, but it's just not funny. Spielberg just can't do straight up comedy. It's there's a whole subplot which is just sort of like completely out of touch because it's mostly about Tim Matheson's character chasing Nancy Allen around and doing everything he can to pressure her into sex. It is just awful. It is so difficult to watch now. It really hits all the wrong notes. casual racism with the Japanese too. That's also a big problem in 1941. Now I'm starting to think that maybe 1941 should still be on the bottom and Ready Player One should be the second worst, but I digress. Twilight Zone the movie. Steven Spielberg directed one of the segments for Twilight Zone the movie. It is the worst segment. I don't know how the John Landis segment would have turned out if it were not for the incredibly tragic events that happened on that film set. But because they did, and because that stands out so much in your mind, it's kind of hard to place that in context of the Twilight Zone movie. But just, you know, the Spielberg segment coming before the Joe Dante segment, which is just crazy. It's balls out crazy. And then the George Miller remake of the Terror at 50,000 Feet. It is just, it does not stand out at all. It makes you almost sad for Spielberg to watch his segment in the Twilight Zone movie. Number 9, The Lost World Jurassic Park. It focuses on almost like the entirely wrong character. I do understand why the Goldblum character came out of that film and people loved him and loved the character, but he isn't the main character, or he isn't a main character, and he's a good sort of like counterpoint character. So it focuses on the entirely wrong character. It kind of sets the tone for what I think, you know, given the last Jurassic Park film, Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom, where it's become less about sort of the mad science of creating dinosaurs, and these Jurassic Park films have continually just become more and more slimmed down thematically to just be about, just basically be slasher films with dinosaurs. And that starts with The Lost World, which is a shame, because it is from Spielberg, the guy who made the original. Number 8, I have Hook. Some people may disagree with this about being the fifth worst Spielberg film. I think how you digest Hook has a lot to do with whether or not you were a kid when you saw Hook in the theater. I think standing apart from that, it is more interesting as a statement of where Spielberg was going next. He was almost saying, like, this is like me saying goodbye to childish things and childish thinking. The next phase of my career is going to be more introspective, more in-depth, more hard, more adult. And looking at it that way, it's a bit easier to have the broader appreciation of Hook. Number 7, The Terminal. A wonderful Tom Hanks performance at the center of it, but the rest of it is just such a weird kind of what I think someone in a focus group somewhere assumed would be Capra-esque. It does not work. I have no idea why Stanley Tucci, as sort of the Homeland Security agent in charge of Kennedy, would be so concerned about this poor stateless man running around his terminal. It's insane. I have no idea why the chief security guard, Barry Shapaka Henley, who plays the security guard, why does he go along with it? Why does he go along with this Stanley Tucci craziness? The romance with Catherine Zeta-Jones was really underdeveloped, too. Everything about it just feels that little bit off. And instead, what you have is these little segments, these little episodic segments with Tom Hanks interacting with the different characters. Some of it comes very close to working, but as a whole, it just doesn't work. And then at the end, you find out the whole reason he's in New York is to get a signature of a famous jazz musician, and then he goes back to the airport to get on the plane. It's just not great. Anyway, the BFG is number 6. Spielberg made this probably 15 to 20 years too late. I did like the relationship between Sophie and the BFG, who's played by Mark Rylance, but there's a real clash in the film because it's done in Spielberg's very down-to-earth, more realistic style, but it's very much the Spielberg trying to recapture some of that E.T.-esque lost magic. And he just can't get there, and instead you get this bizarre hybrid model of a Spielberg movie where he's trying to capture that sense of childhood wonder from E.T. or from Goonies, which he wrote and produced. And it's just not there anymore. He sort of lost that. He's a grandpa now. He can't really process things through the point of view of a child anymore. Number five is Always, and it's a bit weird to end the 80s, like maybe one of Spielberg's most influential decades, with Always, which is a remake. It's a romantic movie, and I don't think Spielberg is particularly well known for romantic movies or even like really romance in his movies. It's a supernatural story too. The thing is, like, I have watched this movie recently, and I still kind of find it kind of forgettable, which may be ironic since it's titled Always. It does not always stick with you. Probably it'll go down historically in terms of, you know, trivia and those kind of things by being noted for Audrey Hepburn's final film performance. I don't know. I think it's very well made, but at the same time, it's very chewing gum kind of, and its implications. I find it very forgettable. Number four is Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. I will be defensive and say I think this is better than most people will give it credit for. Having said that, it is not anywhere near as good as any of the three other Indiana Jones movies. There's a clash of styles. You have the three very powerful forces behind these. Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, Harrison Ford. I think the three of them had some very different ideas about the direction they wanted to take the story in, and it shows that this is a very conciliatory effort, that it's a very compromised effort. I also think that Shia LaBeouf is horribly miscast, and I think he sticks out like a sore thumb. I understand, like, looking back at the moment, like, who else would you get to play Indiana Jones' son but Shia LaBeouf? That's another thing, too. It sort of plays into this trend in movies in the late 2000s of, like, we're introducing this character. We all know who this character is. We all know what's going on, but we're going to keep it as a secret until we decide we're going to reveal it, even though you knew all along this is who this character is. Having said that, I think there's still a lot of good, solid filmmaking craft to this. Again, it does not always work, but I think there is a valiant effort here, and I think overall, I think it is better than people think it is. I think the only reason people think it's worse is because it was not the Indiana Jones movie they were hoping for after almost, was it 20 years? 20 years? 30 years? 20 years. Anyway, number three. This is kind of where things turn around a bit. War Horse. I think War Horse is very underrated. It is not a typical war movie. You know, it's from the point of view of the horse, actually. The horse coming in contact with, going from his farm to coming in contact with the British Army, the German Army, a nice French family, and then back to the boy who bought the horse to begin with before the war even started. It's very episodic. It's not what you would expect from a war movie, given that it's from the point of view of the horse, but it is very poetic in a sense. I think it is. It's sentimental in a way too, that I think it manages to combine Spielberg at either ends of his career in a much better way than something like the BFG does, which is very blatantly an attempt to reach back in time to his feelings about how he used to be as a filmmaker. Number two is War of the Worlds, which is one of two 9/11-influenced Spielberg films that come out in 2005. We'll get the other one later in this series. But watching War of the Worlds, it's a very solid initial 45 minutes as we see the arrival of the tripods and the initial destruction they wrought. We get into this very difficult midsection where it's, a lot of it's about the tension with the Justin Chatwin as the son of Tom Cruise's character, and you get to the point where you're wondering, come on, Tom Cruise, you know you want to leave the kid behind, just take Dakota Fanning and go. You know you want no more further piece of this kid, because he's kind of a jerk, in spite of the circumstances. The fact that he survives till the end, that he runs off into join the battle against the aliens, and then Tom Cruise and Dakota Fanning arrive in Boston, and voila, he survived. That was kind of bull crappy, to borrow a phrase. And also the entire section with Tom Cruise and Dakota Fanning hiding in the root cellar with the Tim Robbins crazy Colonel Kurtz character, I can do without all of that, but the first 45 minutes, solid as a rock, really gets the blood pressure going, really gets the blood pumping. You almost wish that it ends after 45 minutes. It's like, that's a perfect film. Right there. And finally, number one is The Post, and maybe this is like a very kind of personal choice for me, but on the other hand, you do have Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks facing off against one another in a Spielberg film. I would also highlight the great performances by Bob Odenkirk and Matthew Reese in this as well. Matthew Reese plays the guy who actually stole the Pentagon Papers, Daniel Ellsberg. It's a brilliant cast overall when you think about David Cross, Zach Woods, Michael Stuhlbarg, Carrie Coon, Alison Brie, Bradley Whitford, Bruce Greenwood, Sarah Paulson. Brilliant cast that only someone of Spielberg's caliber can bring together in this. Plus, really well made, really sweeping. Really gets you going, gets you involved. The message is easy to decode, obviously, given when it comes out in sort of late 2017, early 2018. It's not a secret why this film was made. And it ultimately doesn't really matter to me either. It's just a really great, solid film. It doesn't have to sort of break the mold. And again, it's a highly personal choice, and I would understand why. Maybe people would not rate The Post as highly as I would. But I digress. We're going to leave that there. We're going to take a break for some music, which may be one of the rare instances you hear Weird Al Yankovic on CFRU. Yes, Weird Al. Stay tuned for Weird Al. And stay tuned for our review of the week coming up next. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU. 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. Take down all those naked pictures of Ernest Borgnine you've got hanging in your den. The stars say that you're an exciting and wonderful person, but you know they're lying. If I were you, I'd lock my doors and windows and never, 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 never leave my house again. That's your horoscope for today. Yeah. That's your horoscope.
Okay, I'm ready.
El señor Walter Mercado.
Walter Mercado.
Walter Mercado.
Que ha salido para ti, Acuario, nada menos que la fortaleza, porque tú estás fuerte ahora, ¿eh?
We grew up with him. I can't think of an English language astrologer that would command the attention of millions of households.
Escorpio, te pones ahora insistente.
Some people who speak English do not understand how loved you are in the Spanish community.
He's very much his own incredible creation.
He's an androgyn. He looks like a woman. Sometimes he looks like a man.
He was like one of the biggest characters, yeah. Not just with Spanish TV, anywhere.
But all of a sudden, he disappeared.
And that was a clip from Mucho, Mucho Amor, The Legend of Walter Mercado. It is the new documentary, which is directed by Christina Constantini and Karim Tabich. I am now being joined on the line by none other than Peter Salmon. Peter, how are you today?
Doing good. Just living life in the good old fast lane. We're in stage three now, getting pretty hyped about that. 50 people, more people than I know, so I kind of pushing me to learn, meet more people, make new friends. So thank you, stage three.
Also, you don't have to choose between who you get to see and, you know, who gets to be in the vaunted circle of 10.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that small little circle.
So we're here today to review a documentary, which is on Netflix, Mucho Mucho Amor, The Legend of Walter Mercado, who, I don't think I had ever heard of him, but when I saw him, I was like, I could swear, you know, in the late 90s when I'd watch a lot of late night TV, like after 3 o'clock in the morning, I probably recognized him from that.
Yeah, see, I knew of him, but that was mainly, his passing, but they quickly show her. But there was the one female who did like the orbs thing, and they show her as like, you know, example of kind of what happened after him. She was a person of color, so anybody watching, you know who that is. I watched her when I was young. She was on the one channel, and I enjoyed hers. You know, I didn't like believe it, but she, you know, she had a lot of cool characteristics.
Yeah, I remember.
So, you know.
I don't remember her name off the top of my head, but I do remember those ads much more prevalently, the Psychic Friends Network and all that. So Walter Mercado, famous in especially the Latinx community. He was from Puerto Rico. Famous for his flamboyant style of dress that would make Liberace look tame by comparison. Famous for his upbeatness and his positivity. Now we were planning on looking at another review initially that unfortunately is not out in Canada yet. So we had to plan for something a bit different, and I gave you the two choices, Peter, between Mucho Mucho Amor and the Charlize Theron actioner, The Old Guard. You chose Mucho Mucho. So what was it about Mucho Mucho Amor that said Peter Salmon more than The Old Guard?
I really love interesting people. And just watching the trailer, that's what he is. He's born an interesting person. He was always an interesting person, and I don't know, I just he pulled me in. He pulled me in like he did all the, you know, Puerto Ricans, right? I enjoyed it. And the other one, I don't know, I like action films, but I hadn't heard about all the reviews of critical acclaim and all that jazz it was getting. But you know what, I don't really think that matters. I think Walter Mercado deserves this more. That's another thing. So yeah, that's why I picked it. Also, The Legend of Walter Mercado, I was thinking about The Secret Life of Walter Mitty the whole time, and that's got an outstanding soundtrack, so it brought forth some positive vibes of that nature, so maybe, you know, that pushed me towards it as well. Just a similar name to one other film I like.
Walter Mitty, a little bit of a different
listen to
movie.
Your heart when it comes to picking the film. You just gotta listen to your heart.
Alright, fair enough. So, yeah, as we've been saying, Walter Mercado was, the film, I hadn't heard about his passing, so the film did a fairly good job of, like, leaving you hanging to the very end, because you almost think he's still living happily ever after somewhere, having reclaimed his status.
But that would be amazing. I had read about him before, so, like, I thought he died in 2019, but near the end, even I was like, maybe I read that wrong. But no, but he was a good age. He wanted to live to like 150, and that didn't happen, but he lived, you know, over a decade above the average, so I'm proud of him for that.
Right, he died at the age of 87, a couple of months after they finished, I guess they finished shooting the movie. It was
a very interesting finale. It's almost like he has just the one last thing he wanted, and then he just got to relax. And Yeah,
I would hardly call it relaxing, but the film ends with this, I can't remember the name of the museum in Miami, but they put together a career retrospective of Walter Mercado.
And yeah, it looked actually really cool. If I was ever in the area, I'd check it out, probably.
Right,
not
well,
probably, I'll do it.
A, if it's not a limited time exhibition in Miami.
I think it was a limited time. It was an amazing setup, though.
And B, if the museums in Miami are presently open.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I really, the one part about that scene, I liked when Walter got to get his own tour of it, and just him and his, I guess, best friend, Willie Acosta. So he just, you know, we got to see him go around and make comments about his own pictures. And he refused to believe the child photo was of him because he didn't look, he didn't look like Drew Walter, you know, he was just wearing some plain clothes. So he refused to believe that was him.
Right. It is interesting that that's sort of where the film ends, this career retrospective, his sort of reclaiming his place as a Latino icon, fashion icon, queer icon, all that at this museum piece. And it shows like he is working like a dog getting ready for this exhibit.
All his like clothes wear and everything. There's one like capes are heavier than any of my clothes. You know, I've got like leather jackets. I got true, you know, flannels. I could wear like 10 of those and it would not be near his weight of just his cape. Yeah, he was a tough man.
And not only that, but like I wasn't keeping careful. Well, I was going to say I wasn't keeping careful count, but there has to be at least 30 different costume changes in this photo shoot. And he's an 87-year-old man. And you're right, too, because there's a scene in where he's meeting Lin-Manuel Miranda, and he tries on, let's loosely call it the Captain America cape, because it's red, white, and blue with a big star on the back. And Miranda comments about how it's this really heavy cape. And, you know, it would be difficult for him to, go out in Hamilton, like, it's a very American cape, would probably be very befitting of the Hamilton, stage performance, but there's no way you could, you know, sing and dance while wearing this heavy thing that's, like, covered in stones from top to bottom.
No, you'd cause some damage, for sure. going back to that scene, I really liked when he got to meet, Lin-Manuel Miranda. It was really cool. I think that since he's someone, you know, everybody knows Lin-Manuel, I thought it was a great way of showing, you know, he was that A-list in Puerto Rico. Like, everybody grew up, you know, and loved him, cherished him. And seeing Lin-Manuel tear up when meeting him, that was nice. That was a warm moment.
Yeah, I was a bit worried that it, like, because you see Lin-Manuel Miranda at the beginning, and he's talking about the effect Walter Mercado had on, you know, people like him who grew up with having Mercado's TV show on, and I thought, like, we aren't leading, you know, we're not building up to when the current, you know, Puerto Rican superstar meets the star of yesteryear, because that seems kind of lame. Interesting, but, you know, lame, you know, I'm not sure what value that kind of, you know, the hero worship kind of thing brings in, but I was very touched by that, and, you know, seeing them come together. It wasn't the whole point of the film, it was this very nice little piece of it, in terms of showing how Mercado was able to build himself back up after, let's say, trials covered in the course of the documentary.
Yeah, exactly. Did you refer to Lin-Manuel as a last year guy? Or were you referring to...
No, he's the current Puerto Rican superstar.
Yeah, oh, okay, and then, okay, because, like, yeah, he's really famous. Even post-Hamilton. Although, didn't it just come out on... I think he's the one in the Disney Plus one, right?
Yeah, the Disney Plus concert... I'm going to call it a concert film because it basically is sort of the live stage performance of Hamilton. But the one that's on Disney Plus right now is the original Hamilton.
Yeah,
cast.
So I thought, honestly, like, I thought it was really great he got to meet Walter. I'm really glad Walter got to meet him because I bet Walter really looked up to him, you know? Walter also, I read this in a different article, Walter was obsessed with Timothy Chalamet. He was like one of his like current one of near his end, like one of his favorite young actors. He said it's who he wanted to play him in a biopic if there ever was one.
Yeah, I cut that in passing, which I thought was a little weird considering Timothy Chalamet's famously French actor. But you know what? To each his own. I mean, Anthony Fauci wanted Brad Pitt to play him in the movie, and he got the Saturday Night Live sketch. So. Sometimes you live the dream.
Yep. You brought up the legal part, but I thought that was a really great part of the film. Really interesting. Yeah, Walter dealt with, you know, a lot of legal issues, so we got to see how they unfolded. And the one thing I really liked about it, Bill Bakula was the guy, kind of, you know, he was the villain in it, and they started interviewing him, asking him questions before they show that. Right? So I thought that was really interesting. You don't really see that the person they're interviewing is the villain until you find out that this, you know, new manager, Walter Mercado, is more of a villain. So I thought that was a cool look.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's maybe one of the problematic parts I have with the documentary is the way it's kind of presented in the film is Bill Bakula, who basically becomes Walter Mercado's business manager at some point in the 80s and turns him into, like, basically a global brand as opposed to just some, sort of like a local, you know, Puerto Rican, I guess, character. Takes him to the, you know, mainland U.S. He blows up in Central America, even blows up in Europe. And then at the end, he gets Walter Mercado to basically sign off his name, like even right down to his name, his persona, which Bakula then, you know, turns into this enterprise where he just sort of slaps Walter Mercado's name on this Psychic Friends Network phone line.
It's like what the British Imperials did to like all the African territories and stuff. They write something that they know, you know, the person signing is not going to be able to, you know, fully understand, and then, you know, that person under the pressure and trust, you know, lose their land, lose their name, like he did, and everything, lose all their rights. So I thought it was a good look at that, because that is, you know, that's a real issue, especially for seniors. You know, the seniors picking the lawyers that you see like on commercials on like Yes TV and stuff. That's not don't use them.
What's interesting though is because Bill Bakula is like part of the film, and
I always love when that happens when interview a villain.
It just makes me wonder, like, is he kind of sociopathic in that, like, he thought he could just come in and talk to the documentary producers and kind of, you know, obfuscate his way through this?
Some characteristics of that, for sure.
And it also made me wonder, too, because why would he do that? I wonder if there is some justification to get, because Bakula is basically saying, like it was kind of like all a misunderstanding. Well, I think Walter knew perfectly well what was going on. The argument from Walter and his camp was that Walter was kind of naive. He considered Bakula a friend, and when he was given papers, he just sort of signed them and didn't really understand. And it's like, I think because the filmmakers do a very like general kind of overview of like the various aspects, not just the, like this specific issue, but the various aspects of Walter Mercado's life, they don't really get into it too much.
It's kind of like
here's this scene from Walter's life, and it's kind of like explained as like why he kind of went off the air, why he kind of like disappeared from public sight, and it's just another chapter. And what I think is there's so much. Oh, of course it was purposeful. There's so much to Walter Mercado's life. You can take any one aspect of it and make a whole documentary out of that.
And he's the kind of figure, and I think he even made a similar comment, he would have, I think, wanted this, a film that does give a full scope. And I didn't see this on Top 10, so I don't know if, you know, it was that successful. But, you know, I think this was a good step. But it would be really cool to see more documentaries with the focus upon his legal issue, maybe his childhood, you know, his kind of long gap of when he didn't do any media, you know, things like that. Because this did leave a lot of questions for those matters, you know. And of course, and I'm surprised we didn't even bring it up yet, a documentary all about his sexuality and what, you know, he brought to Puerto Rico and the Puerto Rico LGBTQ community. You know, I think that would be a lot of fun. But I think this did delve into the pinch. I enjoyed a lot of the figures, Puerto Ricans that they interviewed, a lot of which were, you know, a part of the LGBTQ. And even though Walter never came out, he, you know, they've all said they gave him, he gave them a lot of confidence. And yeah, I'm glad that we got to see a glimpse of that. But I think that's the kind of thing for him that could, you know, get its whole own documentary or a little show where each episode, an hour long, focuses on these things, you know?
Yeah, that would be interesting.
This is a good step. This is the good first step for what I believe Walter Mercado wanted.
Right. They do ask him about it at one point in the film. And
I don't want to see it till after I'm dead. So I'm glad they waited.
He kind of bats it off, and they kind of address it. They kind of address it through, as you were saying, through, you know, people who saw how Walter Mercado lived a very non-gender binary life, and took, you know, their own strengths from that. It's like, oh, here's this guy who wears these like flamboyant outfits, has, you know, the same basic hairstyle as my grandmother, and you know, he's wearing makeup, but he doesn't really address it at all. He just, this is who he is, and I can go out and be that too. I wish that maybe he had been, I mean, maybe if he knew he was maybe closer to death, or I don't know. Maybe he just, that's just not the way, I mean, not surprising, he was born in 1932, so maybe it's just not the way he was raised to sort of, like, talk about that kind of stuff publicly. And so, he just doesn't address it, he doesn't talk about it, which, I guess, fine. But there is something to that, I think, that you could address this in a direct way, not necessarily by getting the answers from him, because he clearly did not want to answer it. Even when they, like, asked him if, you know, about past relationships, it's not exactly clear that he's, you know, he's ever had a romantic or sexual relationship. He could very well be asexual, which is
that. Sorry, you continue.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say that. All this stuff makes him a very interesting, very complex figure. When you're kind of looking at through the lens of how we're negotiating now, issues of gender, issues of sex, and what that influence would be. I mean, you can make a whole film out of that entire conversation, and even though Walter Mercado himself would never address that.
Yeah, I do enjoy that the documentarian tried to get, you know, some more information. And he sort of kind of asked him if he was asexual, right? And Walter sort of kind of alluded that that might be the possibility. But we'll never know, right? We'll never know.
Right. And
he doesn't love, like, male, female. He loves the world, right? So, you know, maybe pansexual too. Like, who knows, right? Who knows?
Well, they directly address it with his longtime assistant Willie Acosta.
Oh, and yeah. They both deny, but, you know, they definitely had a very, 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 very close friendship.
Well, and this is it too. And Willie Acosta basically comes out and says, like, no, we've never had a romantic relationship. He's been my best friend. I've been his assistant. You know,
I loved their relationship. It was really great. I'm curious Willie Acosta is doing. I hope he's okay.
Yeah, no, for sure. It just, you know, it reminds you that things are not black and white. Things have a very, human relationships can be very, very complicated. It's clear that that you know, Walter and Willie loved each other. They shared a lot of life together. They both took, you know, tremendous care of Walter's legacy, and, you know, this opulent house in Puerto Rico where
there's a really nice house.
Yeah, where he lives in fine furnishings and all these religious idols and all that. And it's either way you cut it, it's a wonderful life, or looks like it was a wonderful life, you know, with the exception of the legal stuff, which I can't imagine was a lot of fun, but, you know, it's a great sort of portrait of, you know, things aren't, you know, how people's lives are different, how you can have a very satisfying life that has nothing to do with, you know, the conventional things like family and romance and, you know, romantic relationships. And, you know, you can just be who you want to be. And I mean, ultimately, I think that's the very winning message of this film and why it's important to hear Walter Mercado's story, even if, as non-Latinx people, we don't have that legacy growing up with him as people like, I guess, Lin-Manuel Miranda did.
Mm-hmm. No, I know. Yeah. May he rest in peace. And I'm glad Puerto Rico got him. I would have loved him. And I'm glad that he's still remembered to the point of a Netflix doc. And when it comes to just the layout of the doc too, the one thing I wanted to mention, for the title cards and everything and the flashback, I loved the cartoon imagery. I thought it was great, and I thought it went really well with his style.
Yeah, I like the little animated bits. One of the things he animated was the story he shared as a kid where he found a bird who was dead or near death, and he laid his hand on it and said some prayers, and then the bird came back to life or something.
It was a very fantastical imagery of that past that he had.
Right, but I'm not gonna lie,
the bird might have just been unconscious for a bit, but still, it's all about, you know, his belief in what he gave forth through it, which was a lot of optimism and you know, help for others. But yeah, I don't know if that bird died, but you know, I thought it was a good imagery of him possibly saving a bird.
Right, you're not sure if it's sort of apocryphal or if they're like the bird was stunned or something. But you know,
that's. But I can see also as a kid why that wasn't like a thought.
Right, it plays into the image he has, and the way he tells the story too. It's not about look at this power I have. It's like I believe so. Hopefully,
this is what I got pushed towards.
Right, I believe so. Hopefully, that the bird would be okay. That the bird was okay.
Yeah, and I'm just glad the bird's okay.
and I found that an interesting part of this too. Is we're a deeply cynical society, and you know, part of that with dealing with like the Psychic Friends Network and you know, televangelists and things. Most of us see these people as deeply cynical and as taking advantage of people.
And you're not a Peter Papa fan?
Not really. But no, the thing with Walter Mercado, though, is I'm not sure he was ever selling this idea, like, I am a quote-unquote real psychic.
Really, it was like public TV. I think when you like call him in, it costs money, but not like as much money as, you know, all other phone calls were. He was never, until Bubakula had a lot of more power in the North American realm, he was never, his focus was genuinely never money. Even the one American who gave him some critical comments, the blonde female, I forget her name, even she said it was never the money for him. And that's one thing I really respected. And literally the second he won the case against Bill Bakula, he stopped the whole phone call things and everything. So, yeah, it was to him just helping out the Puerto Ricans and, you know, the world as a whole, his goal, you know?
Right, yeah, but, like, you know...
And I didn't know that going in. So, like, all of these kinds of docs usually about figures like this then go into that, how they're just in it for the money, right? So it was actually a pleasant surprise for me.
Right, and definitely, like, because everyone wants, you know, the good news, everyone wants to know they're going to be rich or successful or find the one, romantically speaking, or, you know, whatever their life goal is. And what I found interesting about Walter Mercado is that his form of, like, psychic reading and fortune-telling was, like, is kind of more of a hype man.
It was he's just like a public speaker, just getting their optimism up.
Right. And there's a scene in the film where it shows one of his readings, and it's like Scorpio or something. Maybe I'm thinking it's Scorpio because I'm a Scorpio, but, you know, he's like, Scorpio, you are very strong. You are going to go out and you're going to use that strength. And it's like, it's not the kind
broad,
of thing.
So it's up to them, you know?
It's not fortune telling,
and it makes it easier to find it actually happening as well, right? Which I don't think if you actually have a religious belief is a bad thing.
No, it's I'm not I'm not even 100% sure it was about, like, here are my predictions. And it, of course, this, you know, in the 90s, he's coming up in an era too where it was very much about end times and, like, it's the year 2000, everything's gonna break down, Y2K, all of that. And then, you know, in the midst of all that, you have this one guy who's not talking about any of that. And
a lot of positives.
Right, and a lot of people in the film are mentioning, like, well, I've never heard him, like, say a bad word about anyone. Even this guy who, you know, tried to rip him off. You know, there's no scene of him, like, tearing Bill Bakula apart. And maybe
no,
that's
not at all. He just seems kind of reminiscent of him in a, you know, a sad way. But,
right,
yeah,
and
never bashed him, never showed any anger, more disappointment. But not even, like, a strong disappointment. Just like, oh, it was too bad that happened, but I hope he's doing okay.
Right, and, you know, maybe that stuff's on the cutting room floor, you know,
maybe
we can be cynical, but, you know, I gotta believe if there's, like, a scene of Walter Mercado losing his blank about, you know, all 6 years in a courtroom trying to get his name back, that would be a part of the documentary. But, you know, in the midst of this, like, sort of very life-affirming documentary, you know, it is in the back of my head that, you know, I wonder if maybe the filmmakers did get too close. I don't know what I haven't read an interview with the filmmakers yet where they've kind of described their own sort of background and experiences.
Yeah, and that sort of thing, you know, it does happen with
right.
documentarians. Right. I'm not sure if the documentarian's Puerto Rican, so, you know, maybe they either wasn't that, like, maybe them not knowing him growing up kind of helped him not get pulled into only focusing on his positives, but I'm not sure.
Right, I'm not sure either, and I find this very much with a lot of documentaries, which are kind of like the biographical kind of stories of, like, guy comes from nowhere, beats the odds, and, you know, I've seen a lot of, there was, I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but the Iron Sheik documentary, there was also a documentary I saw at Hot Docs like 10 years ago, which was about Cenk Uygur, the guy behind Young Turks. And of course,
I just want to quickly brag and say my dad has actually seen the Iron Sheik a couple times, like when he was young, like back in the, you know, like early, whenever he, I think he was, what, 70s, the boxer, wrestler? But either way, yeah, my dad saw him, so pretty cool. And not the current one, the first one, right? The OG. So, yeah.
I didn't realize there was an additional Iron Sheik.
Yeah, and he's in the episode of Kenny vs. Benny. Yeah.
Oh.
Some fact.
I'm not sure it's a fun fact. But, yeah, the thing, getting back to the documentaries, though, is that, like, those documentaries are made by the people who are either involved with the subject or with the sort of permission of the subject themselves. And I find them sometimes to be, like, overly positive. Overly,
oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, like, not as critical. And I mean, that's fine. But I think that's something I've sort of left up in the air for me, is just, you know, maybe how close the filmmakers were. Whether that was, again, coming from past experience, or whether they just got sort of sucked into the Mercado orbit and just, you know, were sort of enjoying the flamboyance and the fun and the hopeful energy. And, you know, this is the push-pull with, like, documentary filmmaking, is how close do you get to your subject and how do you let that influence how you present your subject?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, 100%. You know what? Maybe at the same time, though, they might have just fallen in love with all the people they interviewed, right? And didn't want to break the hearts of, you know, millions of Puerto Ricans. Maybe, you know. So maybe, but the documentarians, that shouldn't have been something that held them back from showing the truth, you know? But we don't know. So I'm just choosing to believe that he literally just was this great.
Well, and I think for a lot of people, you know, there may be something on the back of the filmmakers here, because for a more mainstream audience, you know, this is going to be an introduction to Walter Mercado. That, you know, that they get into it and they don't want to leave you with a a less than positive experience, which of course this documentary delivers very, very well. You know, they didn't want to maybe, especially given the fact that he passed away in post-production, they didn't want to leave a sour taste. And
Well, especially it's pretty soon after his death as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, might have been a part of the reason too. They wanted to make it more optimistic, or like I said, this literally just was the case for him.
No, and that could be very well it. He could be as presented, and there's certainly no reason to assume that he wasn't. And at the same time, there's no doubting. I did enjoy sort of the reaction to him at the opening of that museum, how, you know, all kinds of people, you know, transgendered people, but at the same time, just, you know, regular folks, you know, there's one scene where he's kind of coming through the airport and, you know, he's being accosted by different people. It's nice to see, and maybe to compare it to a Canadian documentary, Anvil, the story of the lost hard rock band Anvil. It's nice to see great icons reclaimed and reestablished and given their rightful place.
Exactly. Yeah, I've heard of that Canadian film you just said. So yeah, I think it'll be the same degree for this. Mucho Mucho More doesn't have a Wikipedia page yet, so I'm worried it's not getting that much popularity. But I hope, you know, in Puerto Rico's Netflix, it could be totally different, right? Probably, you know, hopefully in their top 10.
Yeah, it's definitely worth seeing, and it's...
Yeah,
it's,
it is. It was a well-made doc, I would say. I would say what you said, the negative could be overly optimistic and positive look upon him, but other than that, you know, I thought the pacing was great. It was a good length, and I can see what you mean with the kind of, you know, no broad views, or sorry, it all being kind of a broad view, being a negative. But for his first biopic, I view it in a good way. I think it was literally meant to just give everyone a glimpse of his whole life.
And I would also say, too, it's 90 minutes long, so it is... I think it could have been a bit longer, maybe given some of those issues to me. But, I mean, in terms of just, like, you know, sort of getting in, getting out, you know, getting that hit, maybe less is more... And maybe the filmmakers knew what they're doing in that regard. But, you know, at 90 minutes, it's very fun. It's very tight. It's just a good time. It's just a feel good time kind of doc, which is nice.
Yeah. Any doc fans for Netflix, I would recommend that. I would recommend that. And even though I bashed it, I'm still thinking about Cripple Camp. And I like it. I've changed my mind on it. So if you're a documentarian fan, like I'd say first, Mucho Mucho More. But then, yeah, the Cripple Camp. But I'll end with Mucho Mucho More, The Legend of Walter Mercado first. Yeah, Netflix has a lot of good documentarians, and it does, but a lot of good documentaries, and I want people to check them out more.
Yes, so do I. Peter, if people want to find more of you on the internet, where can they get in touch with you?
As per usual, Mr. Towerack on YouTube and good old Twitter.
And that is it for this week's show. We hope you liked it, and if you want to listen to it again, you can find us on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download it on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday on Podbean, or you can get it through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can find us on social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, or on the Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back Thursday at 5 p.m. here on CFRU for news and politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson. You can go to guelphpolitico.ca for my news and politics site at Guelph Politico, or you can check out my writing about horror movies at Nightmare on Film Street at nofspodcast.com. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we'll be back next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for more end credits, and we will see you then.